I'm delighted to welcome Claire Marney to start the afternoon proceedings. Claire is a senior colleague from Liverpool CCG, a long history of work in the voluntary sector and the NHS, particular interest I know in mental health.
So I work for Liverpool CCG, and my presentation is really about the journey that we've taken to try and take a systematic approach to developing social prescribing. And by systematic, struggling a bit here to get this back in my... So by systematic, I mean one that is connected and reaches the people that it's supposed to support. So all today has been all about communities, and by communities I mean being connected to each other and connected to place, and to some extent being connected to ourselves, knowing who we are and feeling at ease with ourselves. And that's not a surprise, and the evidence base has been talked about very eloquently. And we need to start mainstreaming this knowledge into the way we think about how are we going to address health need going forward. Poverty, on the other hand, the evidence base is equally compelling. Poverty is very bad for our health. And in this slide is very similar to the one that Joe showed from the Health Foundation, but this puts the influence of socio and economic factors at 40%. So when we're thinking about delivery of health services, we need to put those in a context, which is they are a small but very important part of the solution, but they are not the whole solution. So is social prescribing part of the solution in terms of improving health and well-being and tackling deprivation? And this, I love this quotation from Amartya Sen, who's an economist, and he why I think this is so important is because it says absolutely that you cannot disassociate deprivation, the effects of deprivation and poverty from mental distress, basically. And we, to some extent, there is a way in which that impacts on the whole of society as well, and we only have to consider our own feelings when you walk past somebody who's homeless. That isn't just about shame for that person. The whole society and community feels shame. So poverty absolutely has to be put at the heart of the way we think about developing models that reach people that we need to. This has been talked about already this morning. I'm not going to dwell on this, except to highlight that presentations relating to social and economic need are increasing at primary care. There's been various studies that show that it's at least 40%. And I would also highlight the welfare reforms that have been going on since 2010. And for Liverpool, for my city, that means that 55,000 households are poorer, and that it has impacted significantly on the sick, people with mental health problems, disabled people, women and young people. People who were already poor to begin with, in fact. So they're the people who've borne the brunt of the changes. I'm going to highlight as well the fact that the age, young people in their early 20s, obviously, but this is impacting on working age adults particularly. So it's a no-brainer, really, to think then that if we're going to do something around social prescribing, it needs to integrate, needs to have a wider determinants response, as well as a health and wellbeing offer. And this is what we came up with. The advice on prescription is run for us. It's an enhanced CAB service that works into primary care services and mental health services. And we started, it became fully operational, covering and Liverpool-wide, 4 years ago, and it got traction very quickly and is very popular and very well known about by our GPs. And they asked for us a short while later if we could build a one-way in for a total social prescribing offer, by which they meant one that joins up the wider determinants of health offer with a five ways to wellbeing offer. So it's simple, isn't it? Of course that's what you would want. If you're a GP or a busy mental health professional, GPs see 30 people in a day, and maybe deal with another 10 cases. So that, you know, they need, whatever we're going to do, it needs to be very simple. And we started thinking about models that thought about patients and the local population as the beneficiaries, but if you like, frontline health staff as the clients. It really has to work for them. So this is a quotation from one of our local GPs. Who would benefit from social prescribing? These are the patients that keep coming back to surgery, and every experienced GP knows who they are. The woman who keeps asking for sleeping tablets because worrying about her debts keeps her awake at night. The carers who can't cope with the financial stresses that caring places upon them. The young mothers who are making choices about whether to eat a meal or heat their homes. They're the patients we cannot treat with medicine. So it's a very telling. People go to their GPs when they're when there's nowhere else to turn. It's one of the few parts of our system that is universal, even though we know that it's not as responsive as we need it to be at the moment because there are so many people presenting. So what did our advice on prescription, our CAB service, produce last year? So these are the headlines. In a year, there's more than 8,500 referrals in and very few DNAs. They manage 2.7 million debt, and that's priority debt. Some of that is priority debt, and priority debt may be very small debt, like a TV license, but you can still be convicted and imprisoned for it. So it's important. 6.7 million in benefit income, and that's against the backdrop of people's entitlement is shrinking as well. The key inquiry areas, debt management, bailiff action, evictions, benefits reviews. So obviously there's the link to housing as well. And 20% of the people who used this service last year had a monthly income of £320 a month after housing costs. So I'm just going to pause while we all think about what it would mean to live on, what it means to live on £320 a month. So we had this service, we knew we were doing well, but we needed to know more in order to expand and grow the model. That's what we were thinking. So we linked this data, which is in the yellow, advice on prescription data, to other types of health data. Primary care data, which locally uses EMIS Web. Secondary care data, so that's from the Royal and Aintree. So adult social care data, mental health services data. And it's linked, and I think it was, I don't know whether it was Craig who was talking about pseudonymization. It's linked through a process of pseudonymization. So although we have access to the data, we haven't got any access. We can't find anything about the individuals. And although it's on one slide, we actually got a grant to be able to do this last year, and we're just coming to the end of the first stage of analysis. But this is very innovative work. It's a big data set that we've got, and it gives us the potential to really think about whether or not we're reaching people who are traditionally furthest away from services, but conversely in greater levels of need. So what did we find out? Well, we found out that more than half are women, that the majority, that the biggest single group of people accessing our service were 40 to 65. 47% single-person households, 14% single parents, 45% with an income of less than £800, which obviously drops after the intervention. Sorry, increases. We also found out that the people had significantly, compared to the general population, general practice population, multiple long-term conditions, respiratory conditions, a range of mental health problems, including serious mental illness, and that, you know, there was a significant number who were smokers. And I'm going to go back to that maybe. This is a report. This is the profile of a report that came out a few weeks ago from Dr. Foster, which is a national body that brings together health data sets and analyses it. And they were analysing high intensity users of accident and emergency admissions. And the profile that comes through is the people who are, we would say, overusing, or we would want those people to be using other services in a more preventative way rather than having to rely on an emergency response. That people are, deprivation is a factor. They are young, much younger than we thought they were going to be. That they have respiratory conditions, mental health conditions, and there's a substance misuse is a feature too. So very similar to the cohort we're reaching. This is a slide which shows, which you can't read because it's not quite finished, but I'll roughly tell you that what we found out was that about 20% of the people that are using the service are only in contact with primary care. About 30% of them are known to mental health services. However, most of the referrals come through primary care. About 40% are known to acute services, and there's a small percentage who are known to adult social care, which we think is probably a little bit lower than you'd expect it to be for this cohort. And if that's the case, that's very positive because it means that we might have had an impact on some demand. We've also been able to find out that all of primary care is using this service, so all our GPs refer in. And on the whole, the darker the blue, the more deprived the area. So on the whole, the most deprived areas are accessing the service, which is good because we want the rates of referral into this service to reflect rates of deprivation. That's the case for all but two wards in Liverpool, and that tells us, two of the most deprived wards in Liverpool, and that tells us something really important. It means our model's not working in those wards, and we need to think differently about how we open up access routes or support primary care and mental health staff differently. In some, you know, in the biggest sense, it confirms what we already knew, which is that the link between material deprivation, mental distress and ill health is inextricable. But in terms of service models, what it tells us is that if health services screen for material deprivation or expressions of economic insecurity, such as debt or sleeplessness, if debt is the cause, then it becomes effective as a kind of risk stratification tool. We can use it as a way of reaching people who are perhaps further away from services than they should be. This creates an opportunity for us to deal with the immediate, to alleviate some of the pressures that come with that financial and social hardship, but also, importantly, it creates an opportunity to have a different type of conversation, what we might call a wellness conversation, a conversation about what else can we help you with, what else would you like, is there anything else that we can help you with, or even if we want to pursue an asset-based way of looking at things, it opens up the door to have a conversation with people and say, could you help us with this? We've got this project, we'd love you to get involved because. So there's a number of ways of looking at it, but I think those are the kind of main conclusions that we've got, is that it's important to think about screening for deprivation, and we can do so much in terms of financial and... I wasn't going to really talk about this slide, but I'm just going to give you an example of this. So this is... Can you see this? Well, this just shows a picture of a single point of access with a target, which is people get a response within 48 hours. So if your GP phones, then somebody, Patsy, will ring you within 2 days and check it out. But she'll ring you before that if the GP or the practice staff alerts her to the fact that it's very urgent. So you'll get a rapid response, and that signals that, as a health system, we're taking your difficulties seriously. That's the point of a rapid response. These are some of the referrers in, and this is the bit, that's the CAB bit. So you go through a single point of access, and you rapidly you get some advice, depending on what your need is. But our provider has networked with other providers in the city, so now, we don't fund it as a CCG, but they are stepping people on to pre-employment support, confidence building, and other, what we might call economic resilience offers. And so that's a kind of beautifully connected bit of the system, which we are supporting and contributing to, but we're not the design engineers, we're not the architects, it's we're co-producing it with the system. These bits, you see activity, green therapies, gardening allotments. That's, we don't fund that. What we fund are link workers, well, actually, the Department of Health, because we're part of the Health and Wellbeing Department of Health pilot that Joe was talking about. So we've got 5.5 workers to test out whether or not we can integrate a health and wellbeing offer. And obviously, the way these bits of the system network is really important. But this is a journey. We need to talk to all the many physical activity, green providers, the artists in the city, and say, can you see yourself in this kind of model? And if you can see yourself in this model, what would we need to do to make it possible for you to participate? And that's the reciprocity question that we haven't quite got to yet, but that's very much part of our next stage journey. And I think I'm going to end there. If anybody's got any questions for me.